history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories to be told. There are some men and sometimes women who did incredible things for our country, and we want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We don't want to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and as we take that journey, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to hear one today in Porterville, California, from Jim McCrory. He's going to be 96 years old here in a couple months. He doesn't sound like it. And I'm going to test his memory by taking him way back to those early years in really wilderness here in this part of California. You said the West Hills, west of the San Joaquin Valley. If you go up there now, it's pretty dusty. You might find some rattlesnakes and lizards. But you saw a whole bunch of different wildlife growing up, huh?
I did.
What kind?
As a young boy, there were still a few antelope out there on that prairie. It was just a grass prairie in those days, no farming. I don't know how big it was because I was only a boy, but I saw some small flocks of antelope. I saw some elk, wild tule elk. There were no roads or power lines, but there were pipelines ran across there, and they had telephone lines up and down the pipelines. And it seemed to me, looking back, that almost every other telephone pole had a golden eagle on it. I never saw a bald eagle. They were all golden eagles.
Uh-huh.
But there were just lots of them. All of the antelope, of course, died when people would go out and take automobiles and chase them and kill them.
Hmm.
And the elk had to be rounded up and put on a elk sanctuary in Tupman down by west of Bakersfield,
uh-huh,
where they have quite a herd now, because you couldn't have elk anymore roaming free, you know, no more than you could have a grizzly bear.
Sure.
Of course, I didn't see the grizzlies. They were long gone.
You're not that old. I'm just imagining what it must have been like to grow up in such a rural setting,
mm-hmm,
surrounded by nature. Probably not a whole lot of interaction with other kids, huh?
We lived on a pipeline station. There were perhaps three other kids. There was a one-room schoolhouse. And I used to just go down there as a little kid to be with other kids. And I'd sit in there and I'd begin to learn as the teacher was teaching the others. So they let me officially go to school when I was five, which was a big mistake because I was the youngest kid in school from then on. So that when I was a senior in high school, I was only 17. I was only 16 most of the year. Being the youngest boy in a class at high school is not a good place to be. It would have been great if I was a sophomore.
Sure.
But not as a senior.
And I didn't ask, did you have brothers and sisters or not?
No, I was an only child.
Only child.
I always said that my folks took one look at me and said, we'll never make that mistake again.
Well, maybe they just knew that you were destined to be one of the few, the proud, the Marines, as we're going to hear about. But do you remember, as a young boy, having a dream, an ambition, an idea of, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
I do. At that time on the west side, there were a lot of flyers coming over in the old Jennies and that type of thing. And they were building those dirigibles, the Macon and the Akron,
mm-hmm,
and they had them up at by Sunnyvale.
Yeah, Moffett
and
Field.
They flew a lot over the San Joaquin Valley. And I remember laying on my back in the grass watching them up there. And they had little airplanes that they put on an elevator and dropped down out of the dirigible. And he would fly off, and he would fly around a while, and he would come back and hook onto something, and they would pull him up. That all fascinated me. I wanted part of that. But my father had been a soldier in World War I, never went over to France, but he was a soldier, and his brother was a soldier, and another brother was also a soldier. And so I was very much interested in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I dreamed of being a soldier at that time. I don't know really what I dreamed about. I was just kind of a lonely kid. And actually, at a very young age, I learned to read. And that just opened the world to me. I read insatiably. I can recommend that to anybody. It just opens the entire world to you to be a reader.
When you were a teenager, though, it must have opened up a bigger world to you when you moved into a big city for your standards.
Lemoore. Probably a 1,400 population.
Uh-huh.
High school, a lovely high school. In fact, the first money I ever earned, Uncle Earl had the contract to light the football field down there. And he hired me to dig holes. And he paid me like 35 cents an hour or something, which is an incredible amount of money in those days. And I so clearly remember working with Uncle Earl on that project of lighting the football field. When I got out of high school in 1938, the Depression started in about 1932 or 3, something like that. And it got better, but by 1938, it had regressed, and there was absolutely no jobs to be had. I so badly wanted to go to college, so I came. They had started a junior college in Visalia, and I took the entrance exams, which I always had a. I'm just telling you facts. I had a high IQ, so I had no trouble passing the entrance exam.
What do you mean had? You said you had a high IQ.
Oh, maybe I still have some of it. But anyhow, when it came time to go, I had absolutely no money, and no young man like me had a car. I had no way to go. So I really just could do nothing. Somehow or other, I don't remember how I did it. I got hold of a pickup. I had a 60 cubic inch Ford pickup.
Yep.
And I got a rack thing on it, and I got a few dollars, and I made some money going around scrounging, buying calves and stuff and selling them at auction, just living by my wits.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 2 or 3 years, and by then they were starting to build the Army airfield out of Lemoore, and I got some work there. And then, of course, here came 7th December 1941, and from then on everything was, you know, just foregone conclusion of what would happen.
But you actually decided to enlist in the Marine Corps before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I did.
What drove that decision? Where did that come from?
I had a very good friend who was 2 years older than I was. They were drafting at 21, so I wasn't going to be drafted, but he was. And he didn't want to go in the Army. He wanted to go in the Marine Corps. So I said, okay, I'll go with you because I had nothing else to do.
Mm.
But he had to go, so he left because otherwise he'd have been drafted.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I didn't have to, so I stayed home to enjoy the holidays. Well,
and they told you they wouldn't need you till after the holidays.
Right? Yeah, the recruiting stations were full,
uh-huh.
And not to try to come until after the holidays. So that sounded good to me, but of course then here came Pearl Harbor. People say, well, the ones who were here when Kennedy was killed or something never forget where they were. Well, I have, but I remember so clearly Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
I had a friend had a job at a service station on a Sunday, and he wanted the day off, and he talked me into coming down and working in his place. And in the afternoon, a man came in from Avenal, and he wanted gasoline. He had one of those newfangled radios in his car. Never heard of such a thing before, but he did. And he said, something really incredible's happened. He said, the Japanese have attacked us. Do you know where Pearl Harbor is? And I said, no, you know it. But that's, I remember so clearly pumping gas in his car while he was telling me the Japanese had attacked us at Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
And that was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did it register that since you had enlisted in the Marine Corps, they might want you back a little sooner than you thought?
It wasn't necessarily they wanted me back. I wanted back.
You wanted to be
I wanted to be there that afternoon. I just felt that I needed to be there to, as if the world depended on me to be in there, as if the weight of the country did. As I say, that was Sunday. Monday, I was in Fresno at the recruiting station saying I'm ready to go. And yet, millions of other young men had done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to wait until the 10th of January before I was actually sworn in.
You know, I've had some guys tell me that once they went in the Marine Corps and they got to boot camp, they had no idea what they were in for. And other guys say, you know, I did so much growing up, I was already tough, and that was no big deal. What was it like for you?
I got to sleep till 5 in the morning. Many times on the farm, we got up at 4 to milk cows, so it wasn't anything for me.
Uh-huh.
I was tough, and the attitude kind of shocked me. You know, this unquestioned obedience, you know, to a young man of at that time, we questioned everything. We quickly learned not to.
Or you were going to be in some pain, huh?
You were going to suffer for it, yes.
Uh-huh.
The thing at that time that they told us that I found hard to believe, but very shortly after I did believe it with all my heart and still do, is once a Marine, always a Marine. And that going through training and being in it with all your heart, you will always be, I will be a Marine the day I die. as if I was still in my green uniform.
I have the feeling, I'm just guessing here, just going off what you've told me so far, but I have a feeling you were eager to get overseas and get involved.
Very much so. Very much so. However, you have to realize that we were prepared to fight World War I all over again. We weren't preparing for anything new at all. So our training, we were great at marching. We were great at instant obedience, but we were not prepared for jungles or open area fighting or anything like that. We would have done great in France in the trenches, but nobody could envision what World War II came to be, although actually it became a lot almost like trench warfare because the Marine Corps just had the theory that if we're going to fight for an island or something, if we just do it as quickly as we can, even though we lose a lot of people to start with, in the end we will lose less than if we just slowly peck at it. So some of our battles were absolutely horrible, like the Battle of Tarawa, mm-hmm. where we lost 3,000 or 4,000 men in 72 hours.
Yeah.
But the commanding officer at Tarawa had bragged that 1 million men couldn't take it in 1,000 years, and the Marine Corps took it in 72 hours. You know, I really was a buck private in the rear ranks, so I had no authority. I had nothing. But I was an intelligent young man. I could see what was going on. I just really can't describe it. It was unbelievably horrible sometimes.
People hear about Tarawa and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the casualty numbers are just staggering. But you were involved in a battle that lasted months and months and months,
yes.
and more than 7,000 Americans died, and more than that many were wounded. Guadalcanal, and very few people who were involved in that battle are alive today. We'll mark the 75th anniversary later this year. Had you ever heard of Guadalcanal?
No.
What did you know as you were heading overseas? How much did they tell you?
They didn't tell us a thing till we were out to sea about 3 days. And at that time, they told us we were going to invade the British Solomon Islands. The Japanese were building an airfield there. And if the airfield was allowed to continue to be built, it would isolate New Zealand and Australia from the United States. And all the Japanese would have to do to take those countries is walk ashore because all of their men, their army, was fighting the Germans in the Middle East, and all of their navy was in the European area and the Mediterranean. So they were sitting there totally helpless. So that was a battle we had to win or lose Australia and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
If this airfield was allowed to be completed, and the Japanese, they already had control of the air. Mm-hmm. They had control of the sea. Every battle we fought them, we lost, except for
Midway. Well, and if Midway was the turning point from a naval perspective,
right.
Guadalcanal was the turning point in the Pacific
War.
From a land-based perspective. But tell me about your first taste of it, because you weren't on Guadalcanal at first.
No, Guadalcanal only had about 700 Japanese people on it, and most of them were Korean laborers who were building that airfield. And when the Marines came ashore there, they just all ran away. So there was no fighting when they landed on Guadalcanal. There was fighting later.
But you ended up on some places most people have never heard of.
About 26 miles away was the big island of Tulagi, and there was a beautiful harbor there at Tulagi, consisting of Tulagi and the island of Florida. And in the harbor were two small islands about the size of city blocks, and one of them had been the headquarters for the British, beautiful, beautiful island called Gavutu. And on it was supposedly, according to military intelligence, the Japanese headquarters with about 50 headquarter-type personnel.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, Gavutu had 800 people on it, and Tanambogo had 1,500. And the mountains had been hollowed out and full of caves and areas like that. So anyhow, knowing there were 50 people on there, the Marine Corps put a battalion of paratroops landing by Higgins boats on there. Well, instantly they were in over their heads. In fact, I met one of those paratroops here in Porterville years and years later. We got to talking. He told me what he'd been, and I said, "You remember Marines who came to help you out?" He said, "Yeah, when I saw that line of Higgins boats coming," he said, "I thought we had a chance to live." You know, he said, "Until then, I knew we didn't have a chance to live." And that was me coming, you know.
Yeah. But, so you're heading ashore.
Yeah.
And you are 20 years old?
Yes.
Never been in combat before?
No.
So what did you have on you as you're riding in that Higgins boat?
The average Marine was armed with World War I equipment, Springfield rifles, and Browning air-cooled machine guns. And I had a Browning automatic rifle, which was the same as an air-cooled machine gun, except it was able to carry by hand. Mm-hmm. Because of an expert rifle shot, they hung one of those on me. 19 pounds for the rifle and 12 pounds for the ammunition. We were in khaki. We carried a pack. We carried a gas mask.
There's another holdover from World War One, huh?
Yes, indeed. So when we first went over the side, that's the first thing we threw away was our gas mask. And very shortly, we got rid of everything. Inside of 2 weeks, what every Marine was carrying was a poncho, mess gear, anything you could eat, your rifle, ammunition. If you could find them, at least 2 canteens of water, because that's the most precious thing there was. Not one, but at least 2, 3 if you could find them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we carried. All the rest of this stuff we threw away. One of the most almost ridiculous things that ever happened was before we went ashore, we were given a piece of white cotton muslin, or whatever you'd call it, about 6 foot long. And the idea was at night you wrapped it around your stomach and went to sleep on the ground, and that kept you warm.
You saying it didn't work?
It didn't work. But believe it or not, we were given that. And we went ashore there with, in those days they called them sea rations.
Yeah.
And they were little cans of food about the size of a can of Campbell's soup. You got a can of beans, hash, or stew. That was the 3 items they had. And we went ashore with 6 cans, 2 meals. We never got another thing to eat there for 26 days.
Let that statement soak in a little while we take our first commercial break, and prepare to be amazed by how Jim survived when an American bomb headed directly toward his position. Find photos of Jim now and as a strapping young Marine at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.